Tchaikovsky's concerto opening chords. Okay, now the big event. Hit that keyboard. Or you can make the keys whisper, as Beethoven does. And there's a Chopin mazurka from the piano's golden moment of the 19th century classical music era. There would be many more golden moments: the ragtime era, the jazz era, and Oscar Peterson, Elton John and Billy Joel's pop piano poundings, the lyrical keyboards of Tori Amos and Randy Newman, all playing the piano. And that's hardly a complete list. Whither the piano in this century? With the sales of new pianos at a historic low, we have three piano lover defenders with us now. Martha Taylor from Portland, Oregon. Martha, welcome.
Hello there.
Natalia Huang, a piano teacher and owner of Natalia Huang Piano Studio right here in New York City. Natalia, welcome.
Hello.
And here in our studio, Michael Kimmelman, the architecture critic for the New York Times, a piano lover himself.
Hi, how are you?
So to the three of you, what is your most favorite, most indelibly printed on your brain piano riff that either you were forced to learn or you love? Or what says piano to you when I say piano, Martha Taylor?
Liberace.
Nice, nice, nice. How about you, Natalia?
I would have to say Schumann.
Schumann? Mm-hmm. Not Czerny. You're a piano teacher, right? Not the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right?
Yeah, no.
Very good. And Michael, how about you?
Oh, I'd probably be hearing Horowitz play at the Metropolitan Opera, and I was remembering the whole program and trying to pick one thing, as you were saying. Now, probably would include Schumann, too.
Mm-hmm. Natalia, who comes to your studio these days with either their parents in tow or wanting to learn piano, being sort of brought into this fraternity and sorority of piano lovers?
I like how you said that. We have a range from ages 3 all the way up to adults. So it's a good range.
And how many students would you say you have right now?
Well, we also have a studio in Connecticut as well. And so I would say we have a combined total of about 125.
Nice, nice. And Martha Taylor, those pianos never die. They just come to your shop, right?
I actually lie. Pianos are mortal. They have a basic lifespan of about 80 years, just like the human. But what I do, I find pianos that are still structurally sound, cost effective to fix, it will turn out to be something. And of course, I have to like them.
And pianos are made all over the world these days. But in the United States, I bet you can tick off a list of piano makers way beyond Steinway if we were to go back even to the middle 1800s. What are some great American makers that are no longer with us that you probably see in your shop?
One of my favorites is A.B. Chase and Emerson, Vose. But at the turn of the last century, that's 1900, the piano was the major industry in America.
Wow.
So there are gazillions of names
you have
never heard of.
I used to have a Mason Hamlin upright that I bought Oregon, actually.
Oh, and Mason and Hamlin's is one of the shrines of the world.
Michael, how about you? What kind of piano do you have? What do you do in these days?
So I have a Steinway B, and I grew up playing a Steinway C. But
lucky
for a little
you.
While, I had no piano, and so the first piano I got into my apartment when I started playing again after being away for a number of years was a borrowed Mason and Hamlin, which was a wonderful instrument. And unfortunately, my friend who owned it took it back. But you know, I mean, it's always been it's the hearth of my apartment.
And your story of professional training or classical training and then going away from the piano and then coming back is really in some ways the story of our ambivalent relationship with the piano in the late 20th century, right?
I mean, I don't know if it's a metaphor, but I can say it's probably not unusual that, like a lot of people I studied when I was young, I was rather serious. And so I decided against a career at a certain point and then really just moved away entirely. I'd hardly touched the piano for a dozen or more years. It wasn't some emotional breakdown. Nothing terrible happened. I just grew to have other interests. And then I found my childhood piano teacher one day on the street. We bumped into each other. And he suggested we kind of renew our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So returning to the piano was about a relationship I had had in that first stage. And then playing with him, going back to his studio, sort of reliving that part of my life, became renewing a kind of love affair mm-hmm. that I'd had with the piano.
Martha, let me try this out on you. I think Michael's story is a bit of a metaphor for this reason, in that if you played the piano as a young person, as I did, and you grew up and you have the skill, but you've moved to a different career, there's not much for you to do with that skill because we don't gather around the piano in America these days. And that was not the case. We definitely did in the early part of the 20th century. Right, Martha?
Right, because there wasn't any other entertainment.
So I guess if you start playing, Michael, people would say, turn it down, please. I'm watching football.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most interesting things for me about what happened was I started playing again with the teacher, and then he suggested in a natural course of things invite some friends over to his studio. So I did this, and I remember that the reaction was sort of as if your dentist invited you to see him perform in the Fantastics, it was this look of shock. But the experience of playing four friends in a room for me, but also I could see from any of these people who had not, as Martha said, experienced this, what used to be a very commonplace thing, this sharing of music between friends in an intimate setting. This was very moving to, anyway, it was to me, and I think it was to many of them, renewing that kind of relationship to making music.
Natalia, do you teach students to be literate on the piano musically, or do you teach them to be, little Liberacis or little Horowitzes, concert performers? What is it?
So our main goal really is that they should be literate with music. We want this to be something that they can take away forever. Even if, like you said, they don't choose this as their profession, that if they wish to renew that interest, that they are able to because they already have the skill.
And do most of them have mechanical pianos at home, or do they have electronic pianos at home?
Well, so that's, I think that's the interesting change, right? I think a lot of parents nowadays will opt for that electronic keyboard first before they consider an actual acoustic piano. Being in New York City, it has to do with space and budget.
Well, I'm going to ask the three of you to take us out. Martha, think of a piece that someone who's a young person listening to this program might actually be able to play in, 5 years of study to take us out. And then, Natalia, I want you to do the same, and Michael, you do the same. Can you think of one, Martha?
Scott Joplin.
Nice. The Entertainer. Excellent. How about you, Natalia?
All the piano teachers will probably hate me for saying this, but Furley's.
Furley's. Oh, the Beethoven. Of course. Yeah. Of course. I don't think they'll hate you. And Michael?
I think Bach is the bedrock of all great music, and so I think playing the Preludes and Fugues, the Symphonia and the Inventions, there's just a wealth of music there for kids and everyone else.
Piano technician Martha Taylor, piano teacher Natalia Huang, and Michael Kimmelman, architecture critic for the New York Times, thanks so much and happy playing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.